probably a good man, but he has to represent all of Alaska.
State lawmakers make history at today's Attorney General confirmation hearing. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 16th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, looking back on the event 1 year ago that changed how residents of the capital city use electricity.
I haven't ever seen a community reduce its electricity consumption so rapidly as we have seen in Juneau.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by... Support for APRN comes from Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
In a joint session today, the legislature rejected the appointment of Wayne Anthony Ross as Attorney General by a vote of 23 in support and 35 in opposition. It's the first time in the state's history that a member of the governor's cabinet, the head of an executive branch department, has failed to be confirmed for office. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Legislators had speculated up until they began filing into the joint session what the outcome of the vote would be. Most recognized that the vote on Wayne Anthony Ross would be close, but they didn't agree on whether he would be confirmed.
Mr. President, I move that Wayne Anthony Ross be confirmed as Attorney General of the state of Alaska.
Is there discussion?
After 56 minutes of debate, the story of Ross emerged. Senator Charlie Huggins called him an average Alaskan, a plain-spoken, tough guy. Huggins likened Ross to Theodore Roosevelt and Judge Roy Bean.
I know Wayne Anthony Ross, and I will be a yes vote for him. And you know, quite frankly, he may be much too candid for his own good, like some of us are probably most likely.
He was described as a good family man, protective, and as a lawyer willing to take on unpopular causes, for free if necessary. His neighbor for nearly 30 years, Anchorage's Mike Hawker, called his friend bigger than life and an anachronism in some ways. He said what some people find offensive, others find charming, although sometimes not politically correct.
I want someone bigger than life pursuing my interests. And in this case, what I've really come to feel is that should we confirm Mr. Ross, his client will be the state of Alaska. That will be his charge. With the same zeal he has pursued the interests of his clients, the same zeal that has made him bigger than life, drawn fire and defended fire, that zeal will now be directed to pursuing the interests of the state of Alaska.
Through the years, Ross has drawn critics, though, even enemies, and another perception of him emerged. He's fought hard against subsistence rights. He is seen as disconnected with the poor. Woody Salmon of Chalkeetsik questioned Ross's commitment to all Alaskans.
Probably a good man, but he has to represent all of Alaska. Not just one, not just the select few. He has to represent all of Alaska. Whether they're poor, or whether they got money, or whether they're rich, fishermen, pilots, regardless of what they are and who they are. That's the kind of people we have to select to represent us as the Attorney General of the state.
And Anchorage's Bill Wilikowski listed other stands that Ross has taken. He questioned whether Ross will protect the rights of gay people, who he's called degenerates. Or will he support native sovereignty after calling it a 19th century principle? Or the permanent fund itself after saying that dividends should be cut? Wilikowski said the legislature should not rubber stamp the governor's choice.
We heard a lot of talk about the Constitution. But the very first section of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, is the inherent rights section. And that says, I'll just read one part of it, all persons are equal and entitled to equal rights, opportunities, and protection under the law. And as the chief law enforcement officer of the state, the Attorney General is responsible for enforcing that provision of the Constitution, as well as every other provision of the Constitution.
After the 23-35 defeat, Ross stopped by to talk to reporters in the lobby of the Capitol.
The governor honored me by choosing me, and I would have done a good job. And I would have enjoyed representing the people of the state of Alaska. And now I'll go back to practicing law and representing individuals. And I got up this morning, I said, Lord, whatever you got in mind is fine. And... He let us know what he had in mind, so that's just fine.
In a press release today, the governor said she was surprised that legislators in this case really did not seem to represent the constituents and allowed themselves to be swayed by side issues. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Governor Palin is speaking during a Right to Life dinner in Indiana tonight. It's her first out-of-state trip for a political cause since the presidential campaign ended. She is giving a speech at the Vandenberg County Right to Life fundraising dinner in Evansville. The group says the nearly 2,200 tickets available for the dinner quickly sold out and that hundreds of others will watch a live video feed in an adjacent auditorium. Some Alaska lawmakers have criticized Palin's decision to make the trip as the legislature approaches its Sunday adjournment deadline. Republican National Chairman Michael Steele also is speaking at the dinner. Micah Schweitzer is covering the event for Indiana Public Broadcasting. He says organizers say there is no larger political agenda at the dinner.
I spoke with Vandenberg County Right to Life's executive director, Mary Ellen Van Dyke, and she said that although it might look like a political event based on the speakers who are present, Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele is the keynote speaker, and Sarah Palin will also be delivering some remarks later in the evening. She said, really what this is about is hearing personal stories from two people who are committed to life. And she says the reason that Governor Palin was invited to speak at this event is due to her personal story, specifically as it relates to her one-year-old son, Trigg, who has Down syndrome. And she says that's an inspiring message, given that 90% of women who are expecting a Down syndrome child choose to abort the fetus.
It does seem interesting that we have the head of the Republican National Committee there, Michael Steele, and Governor Palin. Do you get a sense that there may be a larger political agenda for this evening?
The organizers are adamant that there is not a larger political agenda. And in fact, Michael Steele was adamant on that point as well. He said he is not here in any official capacity as Republican Party chairman. He said he is here as somebody who has been on a long journey of being pro-life in his lifetime, and he is here to share his own personal message. That is also what we are expecting from Governor Palin when she speaks. Now, media, of course, are eager to speculate about what this means for the 2012 election, and Michael Steele was asked about that. He said it's far too early to speculate about 2012. He said we're only 86 days into President Obama's administration, and so he asked, couldn't he take a break and have a cup of coffee before we begin that discussion? He was also asked about whether Sarah Palin is a potential standard bearer for the party. He said he's not sure about 2012. He said, yes, she is among the standard bearers for the party right now.
Micah, do you have any sense that people are there mainly to hear from Governor Palin? Is she sort of the star of the event, or what's the sense?
People seem to be primarily excited about Governor Palin. Although Michael Steele was booked well in advance of the event, he was booked in the fall, certainly it was when Governor Palin's speaking engagement was announced that this took off and became a headline event here in Southwest Indiana. Vandenberg County Right to Life sent off three invitations to her, one by fax, one by email, and one by snail mail, and were told by the governor's office that they were added to a pile of thousands of invitations. But in the end, Governor Palin did accept the invitation, and I understand it's her first speaking engagement outside of Alaska since the general election in the fall. She was also sent 10 reasons why she should come to Evansville and speak at the Right to Life dinner. And the number one reason is going to be revealed tonight during the dinner. The number 10 reason, however, was a box of chocolates from a local chocolate company. And apparently the governor's office said that Vandenberg County Right to Life had them at the box of chocolates.
Micah Schweitzer is a reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. There's going to be a special guest at the gala dinner during Comfish, Alaska next week in Kodiak. Former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens will be able to make it after all, according to Kodiak Chamber of Commerce Executive Director Deborah King.
And we're very excited that Senator Stevens has juggled his schedule around enough that he will be in attendance.
This will be the inaugural induction into UFA's Alaska Fisheries Hall of Fame, and it only figures that Senator Stevens be included. The hosts for the evening will be fisheries historian Bob King, who now works for Senator Mark Begich, and Kodiak's Lainey Welsh, producer of Fish Radio. The dinner is next Thursday night. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage resident hopes his avalanche story will promote backcountry safety.
There I was, buried, like almost someone had a pillow over my head.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
1 year ago today, a massive avalanche considered a 100-year event toppled several Snettisham transmission towers and lines, severing Juneau from low-cost energy for a month and a half. As Alaska Electric Light and Power switched on the backup diesel generators, a shudder went through the company and the community. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander takes a look back at the event.
Juneau, April 16, 2008.
This is a major catastrophe for our community and a massive undertaking for the company. We haven't seen this kind of disaster on the SNET line.
The Snettisham Hydroelectric Project tripped offline about 3:30 a.m. a year ago. Several hours later, AEL&P learned an avalanche destroyed several towers and about a mile and a half of transmission cable. On a scale of 1 to 5, experts rated the avalanche a 5. Enough destructive force to destroy a small village. Wood admits she shed some tears that day as she prepared to deliver the news to AEL&P's 15,700 customers, as well as her staff.
It didn't take much of listening in the crew quarters to recognize that this was going to be a monster.
The monster avalanche came down along some of the steepest and most treacherous terrain on the Snettisham line, and the snow was still sliding. It would be several days before it was safe for engineering crews to be on the ground. AEL&P President Tim McLeod worried about the risk to those who would have to repair the line.
I knew there would be a lot of pressure to push them down there as quickly as possible, and I knew that no way would we allow our crew to be put in danger down there. So I expected it to take much longer to repair than they were actually able to do.
Diesel fuel was selling for more than $4 a gallon. AEL&P generation engineer Scott Willis estimated Juneau would burn 100,000 gallons a day to replace Snettisham Energy. Juneau residents were warned the hydroelectric project could be down for up to 3 months, and electricity rates could quadruple.
And we came up with that rough estimate based on how much energy folks were using at that time. We hadn't counted on the tremendous effort that people made to conserve energy.
Within days, Juneau had reduced its energy use nearly 30%. The capital city became the poster child for conservation, drawing the attention of major national news media and energy specialists, like Alan Meyer of the University of California's Energy Efficiency Center.
I haven't ever seen a community reduce its electricity consumption so rapidly as we have seen in Juneau.
Longer daylight and warmer weather helped the conservation effort. Laundry could be seen flapping in the wind all over town. Local stores reported a run on compact fluorescent light bulbs. AEL&P sold out of water heater control switches. Even with conservation, many in Juneau would not be able to pay the higher rates. At City Hall, officials worried about the looming economic crisis. Juneau was on its own, its application for disaster relief turned down by state and federal agencies. The Juneau Assembly pledged $1.5 million to help low-income residents, as well as small businesses, nonprofits, and daycares that would have trouble paying their bills. Mayor Bruce Botello calls it community self-help.
I think there was broad support in the community that that was an appropriate use of public funds in terms of trying to deal with the common welfare.
There was no model for the resulting relief program called Juno Unplugged, a partnership of the city, United Way, Catholic Community Services, and the utility company.
We had some false starts in terms of trying to figure it out, but nobody else had done this before, at least as far as we could find, and we were told that this was a pretty unique experience.
At the site of the disaster, AELNP assembled avalanche experts, electrical engineering consultants, and crews from Juneau and Anchorage who took advantage of the good spring weather. They reconnected the capital city to Snettisham in half the time expected. Though diesel generators were shut off, residents still faced 1 month of power at 52 cents a kilowatt hour, temporarily the highest in the state. In the end, 2,200 households applied for a rate relief through Juno Unplugged. The city spent $522,000 helping them. 7 months later, the snow slid again. In January, a smaller avalanche knocked out Snettisham power for 3 weeks. AELNP Scott Willis.
I felt the first avalanche in the pit of my stomach. I can't describe how the second one felt because we knew how difficult that first one was.
But the drama was less. Records show many residents were still using less energy. And now?
I think we're still seeing about 5% conservation over what we were before.
I'm still economizing.
I find that we're pulling our plugs out from our appliances.
Drying clothes in the garage and just being more conscious of lights and appliances.
Mayor Bruce Botello calls Juneau's energy crisis a teachable moment. And to commemorate this day, well, here in Juneau, we're pulling a plug or two. I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Avalanches can take human lives as often and as quickly as they destroy infrastructure. Alaska has had one avalanche fatality this season, a snow machiner who was caught in a massive slide last month near Turnagain Pass. Many more skiers have survived partial or even full burials. Anchorage firefighter Rob Whitney counts himself in that group, and he hopes telling his story will convince others to sharpen their safety skills. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
There are no cars in Rob Whitney's Anchorage garage, but there are skis, more than a dozen pairs, carefully lined up on a ceiling rack. The garage is also home to all the essential backcountry safety gear, probes, shovels, and avalanche beacons, small digital units that allow rescuers to locate a victim under the snow.
I definitely have a good bond with this beacon. This is your best friend when you're in the backcountry.
Luckily, Whitney was wearing one on the day in late February when he and two friends decided to pay for guided cat skiing near Nelson, British Columbia. The conditions were dreamy. There was lots of fresh snow on the mountain and the skies were clearing. The guides knew the avalanche danger was significant, so they decided to send the group down a treed slope they thought would be safe. But on the first run of the day, the skiers triggered an avalanche.
I made 20 turns, and next thing I know, I saw the slope next to me going faster than I was. Sunlight quickly went to night, and there I was, buried. It's like almost someone had a pillow over my head.
Whitney says at first he panicked. The snow around him felt like concrete. He could only wiggle his toes and his boots. There was snow packed in his mouth. He thought about his fiance, his family, and his friends. And then his training as a firefighter kicked in. He realized he needed to conserve what little air he had left.
I was so focused on my breathing. It was like, because that was, you know, that was the only thing I had control over. And I genuinely strongly believe that's what kept me alive, because there's only so much air down there. And if you suck it all up, there's no more.
Whitney says he could only hope the other members of his group were going to be able to find him quickly. Minutes felt like hours.
Probably those last few minutes before I was found, I could kind of feel things just narrowing and getting darker. And it was just this peaceful, slow, quiet, downward spiral. I could just feel myself kind of going into it, and I could tell I was going hypoxic.
He doesn't know if he lost consciousness, but he remembers feeling a shovel hit his helmet. He was still buried, but one of his hands was sticking out of the snow.
And I remember them, someone grabbed my hand. And at that point, I grabbed him back to kind of let him know that, yeah, I was still there.
Whitney was trapped for more than 10 minutes under about 5 feet of snow. The avalanche was relatively small, but it had pushed him into a deep hole next to a tree. He says there's only one word to describe the feeling when the rescuers finally uncovered him. Relief.
I didn't say much. I just kind of took in air, coughed and hacked a little more, and almost felt like I had a bronchitis, you know, just coughing up phlegm with blood in it, probably from the snow that got packed in my mouth, and couldn't get enough air.
Since the accident, Whitney and his two friends have combed over every detail. They want to learn as much as possible about what happened so they never experience the same thing again. Whitney also hopes his story helps remind other backcountry skiers to hone their safety skills.
We're all guilty of it to some degree. A little nonchalant about checking our beacons, testing our beacons. And just because you have the beacon, shovel, and probe doesn't guarantee that you're going to be safe out there. You know, it requires practice, because you never know when you're going to have to use them to dig out your wife or husband or best buddy or whoever it might be.
The experts at the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center appreciate Whitney's willingness to share his story. Forecaster Matt Murphy says too often people are embarrassed when they're caught in an avalanche. He says the center needs as much information as possible to help people make good decisions about getting out in the mountains. And he says talking about avalanche accidents can have long-term impacts.
If a person's buried in an avalanche, they usually have had a life-changing experience of some kind, and it's really good to talk about that, because who knows, maybe 20 years down the road, if there's an article written up about it, somebody might read that and find themselves in a similar situation. It seems like all the things are lining up the same way. Let's come up with a different plan.
For his part, Rob Whitney says he'll be an advocate for avalanche safety the rest of his life. But he says the accident hasn't changed how he feels about being in the mountains or backcountry skiing. He knows it's a risky activity, but he strongly believes those risks are worth it, as long as he's doing everything he can to minimize them. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The National Marine Fisheries Service will be working throughout the next several months to identify critical habitat for the Cook Inlet beluga. NIMFS listed the Cook Inlet beluga in October of last year as an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act. The ESA requires that critical habitat be determined within 1 year of such a listing. NIMFS biologist Brad Smith says a Federal Register notice that was posted this week intends to let the public know of the rulemaking process.
And also to ask for comments and information on what portions of their range should be designated as critical habitat. We also are going to begin our economic analysis of that decision through this advance notice.
The critical habitat study will examine such questions as where do the belugas currently reside within the inlet? Are there areas outside that range that may also be essential for conservation of the species? And what economic impacts would result from critical habitat designation?
And it provides that certain areas may be excluded from designation if the cost of that designation exceeds the benefits, unless the exclusion would result in the extinction of the species.
The Cook Inlet beluga has been determined by NIMFS to be a genetically distinct group from the other four known beluga populations in Alaska. Although subsistence hunts were no longer allowed after 1999, annual counts of the Cook Inlet population has not shown a hoped-for rise in numbers, which has puzzled biologists. The belugas numbered around 375 animals during last year's survey. Scientists are concerned that a large stranding, disease, or other events could cause the animals to dwindle into extinction. Environmental organizations claim the animals are threatened by resource development, sewage and stormwater runoff from Anchorage, and poor availability of salmon stocks for food. It's not yet known what kind of impact the ESA listing and critical habitat designation may have on oil and gas production and other development in Cook Inlet. Comments on habitat designation will be taken by NIMFS until May 14th. Critical habitat will be defined by October of this year. The Center for Biological Diversity released a statement today complaining that NIMFS was moving too slowly on the designation. An earthquake felt by Haines residents Wednesday night emanated from a fault line area of another famous quake that occurred 50 years ago. From member station KHNS, John Hunt reports.
The quake was centered on the Alaska coast, 94 miles southeast of Yakutat and 86 miles west-southwest of Haines. That puts the center of the Tembler near Cape Fairweather between Dry Bay and Lituya Bay. The Alaska Earthquake Information Center recorded the quake at 9:06 p.m. and fixed the initial magnitude at 4.58. The depth of the quake was 6 miles. The Tembler occurred along the Fairweather Fault, which has seen its share of seismic activity. Lituya Bay was the site of a massive 7.7 quake in July 1958. That quake was felt as far south as Seattle and east to Whitehorse, Canada. It caused a large rock slide that created a surge of water estimated at 1,740 feet in height, still believed to be the largest wave ever recorded. Reports of the ground shaking Wednesday night were made from downtown Haines to the Mosquito Lake area near the border. No reports were made of the Tembler having been felt in Skagway. However, the Skagway Police Department received two calls within 10 minutes following the quake of a booming sound that may have been a rock slide. A border guard at the U.S. Customs Station on the Haines Highway said the quake was not felt there. In Haines, I'm John Hunt.
A state panel is considering a disaster declaration by the Northwest Arctic Borough in response to record snowfall in Kotzebue this winter. Kotzebue officials told the state that an unusually high snowfall depleted the city's snow removal budget. The National Weather Service in Kotzebue says the average yearly snowfall is about 40 inches. This winter, the area received almost 102 inches of snow, a record, according to the Kotzebue office. State officials say the city and borough are also worried about potential flooding from the excessive snow. Mountaineering season is getting underway on North America's highest peak. Denali National Park officials report that the first two expeditions of the spring are on Mount McKinley. Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says rangers have spent the last 3 weeks ramping up climber support and rescue operations on Denali.
All the seasonal mountaineering rangers and the full-time ones have arrived. We've been in the process of doing training. The gear has been flown in to the 7,000 and 14,000 foot camp, and we actually have had a staff in there, volunteers, to dig the pits where we'll be setting up the tents.
Pfister says the first ranger patrols will be heading out next week. She says there are concerns that ash that fell on the mountain from Mount Redoubt eruptions could increase the hazard of traveling across glaciers. She says it's feared the dark ash could accelerate the deterioration of snow bridges climbers use to cross crevasses.
Because they might potentially melt faster because of the darker ash absorbing heat.
Pfister says the ash layer is currently buried under snow from recent storms, but that it could melt out rapidly depending on the weather. About 700 climbers have registered to scale Mount McKinley so far. Pfister says around 12 to 1300 are expected to attempt the mountain by the time the Denali climbing season wraps up in late June. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, John Hunt in Haines, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.